What I intend to do is talk about and have you discuss with me the now of the business civilization, which is sort of the current time period and maybe the next 2 or 3 or 4 years. Then on Thursday, talk a little bit about the then. That's the short run, or perhaps 10, 20 to about 30, 40 years into the future. And then talk about the thereafter, which I think, based on my reading, is a time period of about 150 years into the future. So what I want to do then with this three-part series is to thrash out these three time periods. Now, what I want to base it on is some of my readings and some of your readings, some of my interpretations, as well as some of your sort of interpretations, and then a lot of backbone by Robert Heilbronner. Now, there's a book, I just want to give a plug for the bookstore. There's a book by Robert Heilbronner called An Inquiry into the Human Prospect in the Bookstore. It's a very delightful book. Heilbronner is an easy economist to read. He's very lucid. You can read it very, very quickly. He will provoke some thinking for you, but in large part, what I will say comes from some of my readings of Heilbronner. He's written several other things, among which are The Limits of Capitalism, quite a few readings on capitalism, the current business civilization, and so on. The conclusion that I have reached, and which you don't have to agree with, and I hope you don't, is that in a few generations, perhaps in about 150 years, the current business civilization, or the civilization or social order which exists today, it will not be recognizable. It will have changed that much. But you make your own, sort of as we go through this, you make your own sort of conclusions. Disagree. You know, I'm not just sure how the best way to approach this kind of a topic is. I think, or what I had planned to do, was to make some introductory comments, perhaps 15, 20, 25 minutes. I say 15, but it usually drags on a little bit longer. But what I would hope that you would do, I would hope that you would feel free to sort of interrupt me at any time, even during those sort of introductory comments, because I think it's really sort of too bad if you have a good thought and then we sort of let it go past and never get back to it. Now, so the success of this series, if you were to evaluate it, and if you were to evaluate it negatively, I think it would be just as much your fault as my fault. It would probably be because you didn't contribute any more than I did, and so on. If you need some encouragement to contribute, there's a wonderful Japanese proverb. I'm not sure if it is a Japanese proverb, but if it isn't, it should be. And it goes something like this: a moment of embarrassment is worth a lifetime of bliss. So it's okay to make a stupid comment. Most comments aren't, but it's okay to make it because it will remove a whole lifetime of ignorance, you see, if some of us can answer your comments. If you need sort of some other urges to boldness in contribution, just remember that in a science as inexact as economics, we can tolerate input from all sorts of weirdos. And you know, and let me tell you about some of these weirdos. Adam Smith is one of the gods of economics. You know, I use that term sort of loosely, gods. Adam Smith stuttered and sputtered. He was extremely absent-minded, and he was very rude. He probably couldn't hear well, so he kept continually interrupting. He was a moral philosopher before he wrote in 1776 a book that I think made a greater impact on the world than that other event which happened in 1776, you know, the American Revolution. He wrote a book called The Inquiry into the Causes of the Wealth of Nations. We know it as the Wealth of Nations. Among other great economists, there was a madman, Robert Owen, the utopian socialist. Some of you will remember Robert Owen. There was a reverend, I don't know how many clergy there are here, but there was a reverend, Thomas Malthus. There was a stockbroker, I don't know how many of you are business types, but John Maynard Keynes was a stockbroker. There was a revolutionary, Karl Marx, who had a nobleman friend by the name of Frederick Engels. And there was even a Norwegian farmer, Torstein Veblen, one of my other heroes, because I happen to also be Norwegian. Now, their common element was curiosity and boldness, and their mark on society was more important, according to Heilbronner, than the contributions of governors and presidents and kings and generals. And their contribution was the fact that they contributed sort of to the history of ideas. So I want to urge everybody to be bold, you know, to be curious, to be risk takers, and make contributions. Okay? And so now, with that kind of an introduction, let me get started with the notes that I have made regarding the now of the business civilization. And first, I want to start by defining business civilizations. Economists are always great at that. They spend half of their time defining things, you know. The business civilization is really Wall Street. The business civilization is really Holden. The business civilization is really organized sports. It's the National Football League, the National Basketball League. It's really sort of the social order that we live in. Okay. As an another name for the business civilization would be simply capitalism. The business is added as a feature to sort of emphasize what we think we philosophically, I guess, want to define it to be, or what we really emphasize in it. The business civilization, capitalism, is really private ownership of the factors of production. And by the factors of production, I mean land, machines, building, managerial skills, labor power. All of those things are what we refer to as factors of production, and it's private ownership as opposed to public ownership of those factors of productions that we're talking about. In capitalism, in business civilization, then, distribution is achieved sort of through the market system. And the market system features price as its mechanism. To the highest bidder goes the goods. Those who don't have enough money to compete in the marketplace do not get the commodities. Now immediately, you see, that begins to affect the distribution because some aren't going to have enough money, so they aren't going to get. The price system also works in the labor market, you know, where we sort of, I assume that most of us are sort of managers or workers. And that is, we work and we present our labor, our factor of production, to the labor market, and the labor market returns a wage. Now, the wage we get depends on the skills and abilities that we have. So again, it affects distribution. And again, the market could tend to be a little bit unfair, because what you have, or what you eventually get then, you see, depends on the skills and abilities that you have, on the opportunities that you've had for training. You know, we idolize education in our society, and so we think that everybody has to have a certain kind of education, you know, and that's good, because that's how I sort of make my living. And I would hate to see the day when we didn't think college education was really very important for our society. But so you see, what we have to do with, or what we have to buy with, is what we get in the labor market based on the skills and abilities that we have. Okay. Now then, having defined, is that a sufficient definition of capitalism or business civilization?
Yeah. I'm wondering if the two are actually that synonymous. I've kind of gotten come to the conclusion, I guess, from reading some of Heilbronner's books, that business civilization might better be a word to describe the materialist kind of motivation that is evident in societies and in socioeconomic orders, in addition to capitalism, and that the definition that you just gave sounds more like it would be restricted to capitalism specifically.
Yeah. Anybody else want to comment on that? I would agree with you. You know, I think capitalism, well, maybe not. Maybe I wouldn't. Capitalism is sort of the broad framework. Okay. Business civilization is the part of capitalism that I think we're currently about. Okay. Would you agree with that? Or?
I guess I'd look at it just from the other side.
I thought you would. Which is all right. You know. And somehow or other, though, we should come to grips with that. We shouldn't have serious definitional differences if we're going to discuss this. but maybe we can think of that as, you know, conceptual differences and get by with it in that respect. Because I think I'm going to come around to a little bit more of your point of view as we progress through the sort of the three-part series. Okay then, having conceptually defined it, capitalism or business civilization, what is the prognosis? Extinction, I believe, based on my reading. Now, just because I say extinction, you know, immediately some people are going to say, ha-ha, radical, you know. And that's not really true, because one of the greatest conservatives, at least in economics, a gentleman by the name of Joseph Aloysius Schumpeter, 40 years ago, predicted the extinction of capitalism. So extinction, you know, is not a radical point of view. It is just as well rooted in conservatism as it is in radicalism. I think what happened was Karl Marx, the radical, of course, predicted extinction. And hence, everybody who then predicts extinction, because Karl Marx was better known than Schumpeter, okay, have become labeled radicals. And that's really not the case at all. Okay, so capitalism is at least conceded to be plunging, I think, into planning. And planning is, of course, the antithesis, if you think about it, of capitalism. Just kind of look around you here. Right here at Holden, you know, we are beset with sort of forced planning. The Federal Forest Service, the National Forest Service, owns the land on which Holden is existing. The feds inspect our kitchen. They regulate, to some extent, the ingredients and the processing of the food that we eat. They build and control and maintain the highways that you came out on. Okay. They even regulate, to a certain extent, the charges that the Holden Boat Company can charge you for coming up Lake Chelan. They interfere everywhere, the conservative says. Okay. But that's because restaurants would take shortcuts with the preparations of food. That's because food processors would shoddily prepare food, and the boat company would charge excessive fees and provide minimal service if they weren't regulated, says the radicals. See? Both then the conservative and the radical look at the structure that exists. They look at the intervention by government, and they draw entirely different conclusions about the intervention of government based on the perspective that they hold. Okay. So I guess we have to sort of realize this point of view distinction between conservatives and the liberal radicals. And then, having sort of understood this point of view distinction, that is, the conservative looks at regulation as interfering, and the liberal radical looks at it as being absolutely necessary, in fact, for sort of survival. Okay, now I want to try to link that to our business civilization. Okay, the earlier definition that we talked about of capitalism, business civilization, is basically a conservative definition. In addition, the conservative looks at the social system as essentially a static system. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean that conservatives are opposed to change, but the social system remains static. Economic production output can increase. Okay, so that kind of change is positive. Productivity increases, output increases. Those are welcomed by the conservative. But the system, the social system, has to stay the same. The conservative looks at the social system, that is, the working class, the management class, and the owner class, okay, as the system. Okay, and then the changes that take place are the production that come out of the system. Okay. Now, and they think that government interferes with output or production in that system. And so I think one of the things that we ought to do is look at government intervention in that system and to see if it really has been interference or if it hasn't in fact helped business. Now, well, I don't know how many of you are business people. I don't know how many of you think that perhaps the government interferes and makes your job sort of harder and does not support business civilization. But where I teach economics, the majority of the students hold the view, the conservative view, that government intervenes and interferes in the process. Okay. And so I always present them, based on I guess on my readings, three types of government intervention. They're sort of historical government interventions. And so let me ask you, listen to these three periods of intervention, okay, and sort of decide for yourself whether it's interference or just what it is. Okay, the first one is intervention, which started in colonial America, as a matter of fact, to expand the frontiers of our country. You know, intervention to build railroads, intervention to build state universities, intervention to build canals. You know, how many of you think the Erie Canal could have been built without government intervention? How about the Transatlantic Railroad? Or Transcontinental Railroad. Yeah. How about our highway system? How about the Panama Canal? Yeah. Could those have been built? Now, did those stifle business? Did those interfere? That's one form. Okay. The second form of intervention is what we term regulatory intervention. And this is really simply the proliferation of government agencies to regulate. And you know them, the FDA, the FRS, the FTC, the ICC. You know, there are just all kinds of agencies that really sort of reached their heyday, I think, during the New Deal era. We needed all of these types of organizations. Now, have all of these organizations stifled business? You know, think about it. Did the airlines really want to get rid of the regulatory agency that controlled the price structure? Does the trucking industry want to get rid of whatever agency it is that controls the rates that are set for them? How many of you are lawyers? Okay. How many of you would like to operate in a system where there's not credentialization by the government, licensing? How many of you are teachers? Don't you want the government to set some standards for you? How many of you are nurses? We're all licensed. We're all credentialed. We want that kind of intervention. We contend that it interferes, but we don't want to go without it. The trucking industry right now are worried to death that they are going to deregulate the trucking industry as a result of the trouble we've had in the last few years, and they just absolutely do not want it. So I think the evidence here, too, is somewhat clear. But you draw your own conclusion. Is it intervention? And then there is a third form of government intervention, and that is intervention to guarantee full employment, price stability, and economic growth. You know, it's sort of the new era of Keynesian economics. Okay, and it's exemplified by, for instance, the Full Employment Act of 1946, which sort of guarantees Americans jobs. It's exemplified by the Council of Economic Advisers that regulate the economy. It's exemplified by a conservative administration like Richard Nixon's setting price and wage controls. It's exemplified by a Democratic administration like Carter's, okay, setting guidelines. As I said, it started, or at least it proliferated during the New Deal. It may have peaked very recently, because we have evidenced by airline deregulation perhaps the first major deregulation of an industry, the airline industry. And it's worked tremendously effectively for both the airline industry and the passengers. Air travel has increased, revenues to the airline industry has increased, price has decreased, so that more Americans can afford it. Okay, look for instance at the battle fought over the B-1 bomber. You know, whether or not to build the B-1 bomber. Was that really a battle about defense, or was that a battle about full employment? You know, we really have gotten to the point where we interfere in the, or where we intervene in the production process to provide employment. Every American is guaranteed, at least that's what the government says, a job. And that's essential in the type of economy we have, because we have very definitely have a job, kind of, or job income oriented economy. That is, you have a job to provide an income in order to survive. You know, welfare is very, very stringently and stingily handed out in our economy relative to the rest of the world. We had Social Security in 1936. Germany had it in 1870s. Most European countries had those types of income distribution schemes way, way before we did. We didn't get it till the 1930s, and then it was almost forced upon us as a means of, perhaps some people would say, I don't know if I disagree, to sort of settling kind of some revolutionary ferment that was starting to affect. Well, okay, so we have those three types of intervention that I look at, or that I suggested now. Has it drastically affected business? Has it done anything to change our social structure? My conclusion is that it has hardly done that. For instance, if you look at income distribution, that has changed very little. The top 10% of the population received 30%, roughly 30% of the income 100 years ago, 20 years ago, and today. Okay. The top 2% of the population held 33% of the wealth in the early 1920s. That same 2%, or I don't know, there may be some compositional changes, but 2% of the population in the late 1950s held 32% of the wealth. You know, so it really hasn't done anything in terms of redistribution. Business civilization, capitalism, is very kind, I think, to the upper strata, sort of our of our social structure. So in spite of 50 years of increased and prolific kind of government intervention, the social structure in terms of income and wealth remains the same. Okay. However, the system has sort of generated growth, and it has increased our standard of living. Yeah. But the point is, the structure has remained the same. Okay. In absolute terms, we all have more money. We all have more income, okay? But relatively speaking, the stratas haven't changed. The structure is still as it was you know, before kind of the government intervened. Roughly speaking today, and I sort of looked this up just before I came up here, there are about 15 to 16 million families that earn between $12,000 and $17,000, which is what, per year, which is what we call the great middle class. And there are about 200,000 families that earn more than $125,000 a year. Now that means all the rest, 15, 16 million, however many that would be, and the remainder would earn less than about $12,000 a year. Okay. So my conclusion is, you know, it hasn't really, government intervention hasn't really affected the structure. You may have different conclusions. Okay, so let me then take it. So that's a little bit of the of the conservative structure. Let me just mention what some of the ideas from the liberal radical perspective. Okay, the liberal radical's perspective sees capitalism or business civilization as a dynamic system, and looks to this dynamism as sort of a trigger for revolutionary change, brought about because the structure is not changing. People, in a sense, are changing, but the structure remains the same. And the fact that it remains the same, and the fact that people have more information, radicals then conclude or look at that as the trigger for some kind of possible change. The very presence of regulatory agencies, the existence of price controls, the need to have welfare agencies, are all indications to the radicals, okay, that there's something wrong with the system. Okay. Those are sort of the symptoms of fervent, of change, of dynamism in the social order. Okay. And they, when they, the more they see of these, the more abrupt these changes sort of become, the closer we are to some kind of revolution in the eyes of the radicals. Okay. Now, there's one sort of flaw in the radical structure, and that is that they have very little faith in political power. They have little faith in government. And many economic writers would contend that this is where radicals have gone wrong. And they point, for instance, to societies like the Scandinavian societies and the Japanese societies, which are also capitalistic or business civilization societies, where the government has really been able to take over and rule the business civilization, or rule the capitalism, rule the industrial structures. For instance, in Norway, if you were to look at the pre-tax structure or pre-tax distribution of income in Norway, you would find that it was hardly distinguishable from the pre-tax income distribution in the United States. Very little difference. The same number of families have the same sort of percent of the income. Okay. After taxes, the American income distribution changes like almost infinitesimal. The Norwegian income distribution drastically changes by taking income away from those who have, redistributing it to those who have not. In Japan, for instance, the government has decreed almost that business organizations take care of the unemployed. And they've done it by just simply stating that the Japanese organizations owe their employees a lifetime job. In the United States, that's absolutely not the case, you know. Every individual is on his own in the United States with respect to job. We provide minimal unemployment compensation, you know, that sort of stuff. Now, I guess I want to make one more point regarding sort of this radical point of view, and then look at a couple of problems, and then perhaps throw it open for discussion. Okay. The radicals also contend, to some extent, that the political power and the economic power work together. Sometimes well, sometimes poorly, but at least they sort of work together. and they coexist. Okay. Now, most economists, at least that I have read, will agree, and now this is coming from economists now, that the economic structure, that the economic force ought to be subservient to the political structure, to the political force. That is, the political force ought to rule the economic structure and not the other way around. Now, that will become important later on when we talk about the changing nature of the type of business organization or business civilization that we live in. Because I believe, anyway, based on my readings, that the only way we can have any kind of revolution, which I don't really believe that we're going to have, I think it's going to be much more evolutionary than revolutionary. The end result, I might as well tell you right now, at least I believe that we will have some kind of authoritarian kind of structure where the political rules completely the economic structure. And that the radicals, I think, today still sort of haven't caught on to that. Yeah. They perhaps have. I'm sure they have. You know, but they're probably not ready to grant that yet. Okay. So we've had then these kind of opposing forces: this radical force, this conservative force, existing. And doing quite well, just sort of arguing with each other, and not much has happened in about 100 or in about 200 years with respect to that structure. But there are some problems. There are some cracks that are sort of now beginning to appear, and which Heilbronner, some of you have read Heilbronner, I noticed two or three people carrying Heilbronners around. I think you have one, right? And the rest of you. Heilbronner suggests that there are perhaps a couple of cracks that, as evidence of the fact that something will happen. Okay. And the first one is a problem relative to the shrinking environment, or shrinking environment, I want to say, relative to the population. Okay. And notice the effect that this kind of shrinking environment relative to the population has on business activity. I was watching Jim Smith's slideshow over in the Village Center the other night, and he showed some beautiful pictures of the Cascade Range. Do you remember that? And then he showed a nice mountain view, and he said the Anaconda Copper Company owns a big claim right here. And he says, and one of the forces preventing Anaconda from mining that is public pressure. There are some other forces, but one of the forces, public pressure. Okay? Hence, there is some cracks. You know, business civilization is starting to some extent to adhere to that point of view. You don't see anymore mine tailings like the one that this village has to contend with. You know, we reclaim those anymore by somehow or other covering them with something so that vegetation can grow on them. All of that, you see, increases the cost, which increases the price, which decreases kind of production in a way and slows down the growth of the business structure. And then there are some other problems, and those are sort of serious disorders in the economic system, and I'll just name them and you'll know them immediately. Inflation, okay? How many of you would not like the government to control inflation? Okay. Unemployment. How many of you would want to eliminate unemployment compensation? Yeah. Try telling that to the average American. How about the International Monetary Fund? How many of you would like to have gone through the 1972 collapse or almost collapse of the international monetary system without having had the International Monetary Fund there, you see? So there are sort of cracks. Serious city problems. Look at New York City. What would New York City have done? Okay. The railroad system. The solution was government intervention, you see? But those are cracks. And those are cracks when problems are accelerating. the curve, I think of events like that is sort of an exponential curve. That is, that it's increasing at a faster rate. So all of these seem to indicate that we require government intervention. Government intervention is expected. As a matter of fact, I think we are now at the stage where we think we want to interfere more effectively. And you interfere more effectively by planning. Okay? And I guess that's where I started. Capitalism is sort of sliding, according to some people, I think, sort of jumping into a planned kind of society. And I think that's probably sort of the beginning of the end of the business civilization. Okay, now, those are sort of my remarks, and I did take more time than I thought I would, and I usually do. I guess I hope now that, if we don't want to be failures, right? So you're going to have to make some contributions and make some comments and suggestions. And remember the Chinese or the Japanese proverb or whatever it was, and so on. But would anybody like to contribute? Yeah.
I wonder if it might be useful to differentiate between the so-called paleoconservative and the neoconservative views of government intervention. That most conservative thinking these days that is intellectual, comes from intellectual sources, is neoconservative and sees government intervention as being necessary, okay, as you're saying, and is distinguished from the paleoconservative, which is more the position that free enterprise should be allowed, and in the past, when it has been allowed, has provided more benefits to the society than it has since government.
Who are the paleo conservatives then? The libertarians, that type of
Friedman and
do you think Friedman? Do you know Friedman? Milton Friedman. He writes a column for Newsweek, among other things, and he is sort of one of the other one of the other gods of economics. But some people contend that Milton Friedman has sort of gotten himself into the corner. You know, after years of arguing this conservative point of view, he can't. You know, and at least not until he wins the Nobel Prize can he back off from the point of view that he has sort of, well, wait a minute now, he won the Nobel Prize, so maybe now he can start backing off. But anyway, do you think that's a useful distinction? I wouldn't, you know, in this kind of general presentation, I don't know.
What are some of the, you say that there's going to be more planning, that include a lot more environmental planning, and what are some of the things that you foresee will be planned?
What we probably won't see so many new thrusts in planning or in intervention. Where I think the planning will enter is to try to make the thrust that we have made more efficient, more effective. In other words, planning to try to save capitalism or the business civilization in a way, planning to try to make the structure mimic the market system. You know, for instance, there are two ways to regulate pollution, right? One way is to fine somebody for in a way for polluting, you know. And another way is to try to provide some kind of incentive system. I didn't mean that. One way, first way, is to forbid regulation or forbid pollution. You absolutely can't pollute. Okay. Now that's not very efficient. You know? The second way would be to try to regulate pollution sort of by having the people who pollute pay for it. And pretty soon, a utility company that pollutes too much are going to have to pay such heavy fines that that's going to jack up their prices, and people are going to cut back on their sort of use of utilities or whatever. You know, if the chemical company pollutes, you know, their chemicals are going to become more expensive because they're going to have to pay for the air they use up. But but to sort of say that you can't pollute is really very dumb when you think about it, because there are some industries that are easier to control than others. You know, and there's an experiment in California which I thought was really a very, very good example of trying to have the market system regulate or plan pollution. And there was a chemical company and a utility, or an oil refinery and a utility company. And it's harder, apparently, to stop the oil refinery from polluting than it is the utility company. Okay. And so they got together and added up the amount of pollution that the two companies, that the utility company and that the oil refinery could pollute, and then they sort of apportioned, that is, the oil refinery paid the utility company for acquiring part of their right to pollute. Okay. And you see, the sum of it is that both of them polluted only a certain amount, and together they were able to meet the regulation. Okay, now that's what I mean by, you know, that kind of planning. You know, planning to make the railroads perhaps more efficient, planning to make the transportation industry, you know, more efficient. Now that's working within the market structure, see, because that's what the market structure would have done. You know. There's a tremendous market structure is funny in a way in that it penalizes, you know, people who don't really produce and sell, you know, what people want. If you're trying to produce something that people don't want, you aren't going to sell it. By the same token, if you produce what people want at a higher cost than somebody else, then you're not going to sell yours. And so you have to be sort of cost efficient. Okay, and we're trying to. So the market structure is extremely efficient in terms of producing output. Okay, and that's what we mean. That's what we're trying to plan to make the rest of the structure as efficient as the market structure, I think.
I'm having trouble with your definition of planning. My definition of planning is planning for the long-range benefit of the people rather than any particular segment of society or business. And apparently you're defining it as a benefit to a particular segment of society rather than population.
Yeah, I think planning is much more peaceful than, you know, than you. I don't think. Well, go ahead. Do you want to make?
This is the way it is right now, piecemeal, I think. And I don't think we can have planning for the benefit of the population as a whole until you change the type of system that we have, the free enterprise system. As long as we have that, we're going to have planning for the benefit of a particular segment of society. And I don't know if that's the kind of planning that we want. It doesn't seem like it's been very good over the past 40 or 50 years. We really haven't been looking at the overall benefit of society, but at just portions of that society.
Do you have any way that you think we might achieve that kind of an overall planning structure? Or just generally?
Well, I say it can't come unless we have a change in our total, our structure of the free enterprise system.
Earlier, I guess I mentioned that I thought before we had some kind of revolution or whatever we want to call it, I thought we needed to have the political force, the political power, sort of rule the economic power. If that happens, then I think perhaps we can have the type of planning that you have. But I think the economic forces are still too powerful. And I think everybody wants to intervene to get exactly and precisely the type of planning that's best for them. You know, you want your industry to be regulated if it benefits you, but you don't want somewhere, some industry where you're a consumer, you know, to be regulated. You want that to be free operating within the sort of the market structure, you see.
Everybody has a selfish interest somewhere.
Yeah, we're still operating according to that sort of Adam Smith, you know. Except Adam Smith said everybody sort of operating in their own self-interest will operate for the best of society. and that may have worked then, but I wonder if that, you know, sort of works anymore. At least it doesn't seem to. Some people will say we've interfered so doggone much that we have no semblance of that kind of a structure or that kind of system left, and that if we obliterated all regulations and went back to that laissez-faire type of structure, you know, but good grief, you know, that's hardly possible.
Well, I don't understand very much about economics, but this is one of these Japanese problems. if free enterprise means supply and demand, it seems to me that one of the problems is that we have artificially created demands. I mean, from Madison Avenue and all our TV, I mean, they tell us what we are expected to buy, and as soon as we start saying we don't want to buy your junk, that's going to throw a monkey wrench. And the other thing is, I think I read where 54% of our dollar goes for military spending, our tax dollar, which is not anything that you sell. I mean, isn't that one of the reasons that the system as we know it now isn't functioning like it was conceived in the beginning?
I guess I make it kind of a general comment and see how that flies out. I think we have sort of a very individualistic society or philosophy in our society. And into that kind of individualism, you know, we have, or in that individualistic philosophical structure, gee, does that sound right? We have created a very, very collectivistic kind of society. You know, I don't want to call it communistic because, you know, some people tend to be turned off by that. But we have collectivism amidst, okay, this individualistic philosophy. And I think that's sort of a cultural contradiction, that people try to be individualistic. And so we kind of propose individual action. If we all did this, you know, and if we all didn't buy this when the price was too high, and if we all restrained from doing this, okay, then the system would change. I guess I think that the system is by now so collectivistic. You know, the government is such a large part of it, and the defense spending, you know, and so on, that individual action has minute, insignificant effect. And I guess I spend a lot of time arguing with my colleagues about that. They're at the point now where they're saying individual action does make a difference. I think it doesn't, you know, and that's really frightening, in a sense. Now, I don't know if that in any way answered to your comment. I think we have created this collectivistic society, and it's Daniel Bell calls this the cultural contradiction of capitalism, and he sees this as one of the destructive elements in the society, in that we pump up everybody with individualism. You run out and do what you want. You be an individual. You go get an education and get a job, and then bang, smack, you run right against the collectivistic structure where you have to live with rules and sort of regulations. So he says we haven't really faced up to, you know, the society that sort of exists.
As far as long-range planning, our politicians are not going to long-range plan as long as they have to go to the oil companies for money to get elected every 2 or 3 years. We need some people in Congress that are there for a long enough time that they can set their minds to long-range plan.
Yeah, that's supposed to have been the bureaucrats. Is that how you perceive?
They're not doing their job then.
That's a can of worms.
I don't want to handle that with even that size bowl, you know. And so, but that's perhaps right. Will you? some people have long suggested that we have sort of one term, you know, people. What you're suggesting is even more than that. You're suggesting a permanent...
Not permanent, because that wouldn't work either. But why can't the lawyers go for 10 years?
Yeah.
Or the farmer, or the whoever, the teacher. I could have gone as a teacher for 10 years.
Yeah.
And stayed and worked on long-range planning, which people do in summer workshops all the time.
Yeah. I'm glad you sort of altered that statement. You said that. Why don't lawyers go, you know, and changed it to teachers and farmers, because we're part of the...
in large proportion, we know that.
I think part of the problem is we have too many lawyers.
That's exactly right.
In government, that is. You know, somehow or other, a prereq for going into politics is becoming a lawyer. And I think lawyers are educated just exactly the wrong way to become good politicians. Sort of narrowly defined, you know.
They can read it, though.
Yeah, and they write it, so they are the only ones that can read it. My good friend says that lawyers, he said, the profession of law... How does he put this now? Is like a Greyhound bus hurtling down the highway forward at 70 miles an hour with everybody looking in the rearview mirror. You know, they're sort of something there. Then, you know, that may.
And to get this planned society, then that would be politically free of economic power, would be very difficult, because right now economic power determines the political scene.
That's right. Yeah, and I don't, you know, and would you even want political absolute rule?
No. Keep lawyers out.
No, they have to be in. We have to have that, the brain power.
You don't have to have that. You can hire them to write your laws, but you don't need them to write them for you.
I think there's a pretty obvious distinction, though, between... the political control of the economic system and autocratic control. And when you gave your talk, you made it sound as though political control would automatically be non-democratic.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not sure I intended that to be as much that way, because I think... radicals, as a group, I think, have too little faith in that, you know, sort of politics or in democracy. And but where would you take that? You know, how would you see that changing the structure?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean when you say that radicals don't have faith in politics or democracy.
Well, it's somehow or other, this notion of democracy and individualism and, you know, freedom and everybody do, or the system is going to respond to whatever the individuals want. Okay, that's what I mean by politics and so on. I think the radical would say that there are power structures that control that. You know, that control politics, sort of the whole notion of the elites, the large business corporations, you know, those tremendous lobbying groups are really the people who control politics. Instead of, I thought what you were proposing was individual control of politics.
How many lobbies are there for every politician?
I don't know, but there's...
I heard there's 40 or 50.
For every
single politician.
Yeah. Group, and I guess group politics would, or lobby politics would suggest that these powerful lobbyists represent a group of people, so they are sort of they're collecting individual opinions and aggregating them and then presenting that point of view, you know, to Congress and to the lawmakers and so on. And I'm just not sure that that's what's happening. I think there are all kinds of special interest groups that are lobbying to legislatures. And
I can't,
that's where...
I can't get the distinction you're making right there. I'm having a lot of trouble with that. To me, it sounds like you're saying the same thing, or I view them as the same thing. Special interests are the collective interests of a special group. Now, it seems to me that that's what we really want. But that's what our political system desires, is democracy. It's the interest, that my interests are served, that your interests are served, that you vote your position, that I vote my position.
Mm-hmm.
I do that at the polls, and I also do that in the marketplace.
I don't see any distinction there.
I'm having trouble getting to some revolution as a result of this.
Does everybody hear what he has to say? How do you grapple with that? He sees in now you state your own point of view.
Okay, I vote my interest in the marketplace, and I vote my interest at the polls. In both cases, it's my special interest. A lobby is a special interest group. I don't see anything wrong with that. That's democracy. And I can't quite get around to another position that I would rather have than the position I already have.
Would anybody like to rebut that?
I would.
Okay, couple of, go ahead.
I think where I have problems with lobbyists is that they may or may not be serving, you know, my interests. I had so many thoughts go through, I don't know if I can articulate them very well, but there's a lot of greed involved with lobbyists, and that's where I have trouble. There are a lot of people with very special interests, and they all have a dollar sign to them. They're not special interests for the people, they're special interests for the
pocketbook. Well, where did they get the dollar?
Right.
You see, you voted your position in the marketplace. You gave them that dollar.
I did not vote for lobbyists.
No, you vote for, you perhaps bought a gallon of gas.
Okay. It's a trap.
Yes, it really is. But I don't see that's what I'm saying. I don't see any other position that I would rather substitute for that.
There's another rebuttal from back there, and then you can be next.
I think the problem is with me is that it's not really a democratic system. Take the American Rifle Association, which has a very strong lobby and a lot of wealthy people behind it, whereas something like Bread for the World, which I would like to be a lobbyist for and has a lobby, there are not many of us who really can support it very heavily, and the poor person that needs a strong lobby gets no voice in Congress at all. So if it was truly democratic, I think it's a beautiful way to let our things be known, but I don't see how you can get around the money that it takes to put so many lobbyists on one thing. It's
okay.
Going to always serve the wealthy people.
I personally don't like guns, and I don't own any guns, and I don't advocate guns for my children or anything else. But the National Rifle Association got its money from people who evidently support that activity. I'm in a minority there. It's a perfect example of democracy as far as I understand.
I think we need a clarification of terms. There's a difference between a lobbyist and a special interest group. A special interest group is one that is formed usually of people, lawyers, or on a particular issue that is formed to deal with that issue, and usually it breaks up. A lobbyist is usually one that is supported by a company or an organization that is fighting for that organization. Secondly, you stated that you thought you were voicing your opinions by voting. Well, really, are you? Because if you look at the politicians and the issues that they are dealing with and the results of their issues, really, who are you voting for? There isn't that much choice in the electorate unless you are very involved in the party system.
It's the only choice I have.
Yeah, unless you are involved directly or immediately, very active in the government, there isn't that much choice.
Yeah,
I think one of the problems is that sort of a silent majority or something like that for whom the legislator himself is supposed to be the lobbyist. And that's part of the problem.
But the legislator, I follow those, some of that, but the legislator is not all-knowing either.
No.
And for that reason, lobbying situations arise.
Right. But it's part of the democratic thing.
voting for the person who represents you, just as the economic structures have people who represent them, and Bread for the World have people who represent them. The people who actually do the voting are in a sense one of the lobbyists, for being very much influenced by the other lobbyists. That there's a special lobby to the legislators, because they're already our lobby.
Yeah, sure.
I think maybe part of the problem lies in the fact that we are trying to operate, trying to use a democratic form of government in the midst of a socioeconomic order that promotes and enhances and says, yes, that's good, to a system of class privilege where, as he was saying, the relative distribution of income hasn't changed that much in 100 years, so that you don't, it isn't one person, one vote. It depends on how much money you have, which class you were born into, how much money you inherited, what kind of deals you can arrange because you are more conniving or more cunning than the other person, and it's your pocketbook that is really the vote, more so than your little mark, you know, on the polling.
Well, that's my point, that we do vote with our pocketbooks, and that's the free enterprise system that you've described as it exists.
Does it, I guess.
Less money don't seem to have as much of a vote.
That's true.
Because that's then true. You're back to money winning.
Yeah. There's one little thing I mentioned. I don't have the statistics with me, but you supported the changelessness of the class structure by quoting the top 10% or 2% or whatever. There is a considerable change in the bottom percents, and that's where it really counts.
In relative terms, do you think? In relative terms?
Well, at least that's the way I remember it, but I don't have the statistics with me.
Yeah, I don't either, so we would sort of be arguing what we remembered, you know, rather than facts. I'll try to look it up. I'm sure there are some books in our library where I know that it's the absolute terms. It's changed, but relatively speaking, I'm not sure. Go ahead.
If our vote is ours depends upon our pocketbook, that is not democracy. Democracy is vote for all people, and the people without money, they don't have any votes. You can look at the law system. The people with money usually gets out of things. Look at Patty Hearst. Now, she was an average, poor person. She would be in prison, you know, but Nick was wealthy. And that is not democracy.
Well, no one's claiming this. I don't think anybody really claims some kind of platonic, pure system at work anywhere in any system.
Never
happened. Certainly, yeah. No, we haven't had democracy ever.
The accident of birth can occur in any economic system on this earth, and it's as effective anywhere. I mean, there are people without votes everywhere, regardless of the political system we have or the economic systems that exist here.
Oh, I think that's true. The problems are the same regardless of the structure. Yeah, go ahead.
To go back to your statement where you were, or your comparison between the United States and Norway in after-tax equalization, or whatever you want to call it. In Norway, then, would not that tend to create a society of underachievers, since there is no reason to become you can't get wealthy then, apparently, or you can't move up your social structure, you can't move higher then, because they tax you higher.
Mm-hmm.
Where would the United States be if that was, this whole nation has been built on that economic climbing.
Mm-hmm. One thing we see that effect already in the labor union, the power of the labor union. That the drive for excellence simply is diminished.
I guess my thought on this would be, what do I care what Norway's doing?
Well, I don't think they're all that perfect now anyhow. I think they're beginning to have some
The European
problems
countries
there,
have been falling apart. for years economically.
Except that the standard of living in the Scandinavian countries is probably now higher than it is in the United States.
Well, see, maybe we're.
U.S. used to be number one, but I think we're now number seven or eight. You know, the Scandinavian countries, Switzerland, and then, you know, of course, the oil-rich countries, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, the Arab Emirates, you know. So Switzerland is higher than we have.
France is very close.
Yeah, Germany, West Germany is very close, you see. And so, but that's, you know, not hardly evidence to kind of refute your sort of problem. Socialist societies do have a tremendous problem with incentives, and I think, you know, how do you motivate, how do you incent, or how do you incent? You know, how do you provide incentives?
Part of the problem, too, with, like, a socialist planned economy, too, is that it's planned, like, say, the Soviet Union is planned to such a great degree that they have their quotas per month, and at the beginning of the month, they don't have materials or anything, and I mean, it's right after payday, and the people are still feeling the effects of the weekend, of, you know. And so the efficiency at the beginning of the month is nil, and so consequently at the end of the month, they have to fill their quotas, and, you know, it's just a rush to get it done. The quality of the construction of things is very, very poor.
It's interesting. I've read, you know, in the Wall Street Journal, and I read the Wall Street Journal religiously, that means every day. Or
5 days a week.
Pardon?
5 days a week.
That's right. 5 days a week. Every working day. No, 5 days a week. But I've read in the Wall Street Journal where they have sort of recounted how the communist societies are starting to mimic market structure. You know, they, as a matter of fact, the big item in certain communist countries are genes. You know, and perhaps some of you have read the very same stories. You know, there is a factory in Romania that operates sort of on the free market kind of a structure, and an output in that particular factory is between 2 and 3 times as great as in some of the other planned factories, you know, and they have an incentive system. You're paid. It's kind of a piece rate type of pay system back there.
Well, isn't it true, and this is an honest question, that the countries which have had relatively stable political systems and socialist and fairly high socialist economies, such as Sweden and Britain, and not such as Italy, are trying to get, the people are dissatisfied with socialism and are now trying to make a move back toward a more of a free economy?
Yeah, that's because I shouldn't, let me comment on that and then you can make your comment, okay? I think that the problems are entirely the same with respect to distribution in whether you're in a socialist economy or in a capitalistic economy. Production is planned, but distribution becomes pretty much the same, you know, in both types of societies. And so the distribution problems, that is, who gets the goods, you
know, yes,
become essentially the same. And so whether a socialist society goes towards capitalism or a capitalistic society merges towards socialism, you know, in neither place does there seem to be a answer for the future. You know, neither society, both societies have the same problems in the long run and can't handle the long run problems that we're going to have.
Well, it seems
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to make a comment. That all of these, we're just talking about material things. You know, what are these societies providing as far as sort of spiritual or personal growth?
Who would like to?
The individual.
Well, but we don't, I don't, maybe this is wrong, but it seems to me that people in some ways define themselves largely by their work. And I don't know if that's true in every society or not, it's only true in the ones I've observed, which are Western societies. And if people feel that their work isn't really significant, or that they don't have, if they can't in some way feel a little bit in control of what they're doing, then I think they're dissatisfied with it.
before you run across alienation, as Karl Marx.
I think that, you know, spiritual and personal growth may be more closely tied with economic systems than we're thinking.
Yeah, can we have your comment?
Most of it has been said by the last two or three, four people. Just that it is true that the converse is also true, that capitalism is moving towards socialism, possibly as much and maybe in as many ways as the reverse is true, and that both economic systems have material progress or material wealth as the one, if not the primary goal to which they're headed, and that the spiritual satisfaction of people is not one of the, probably not even in the top 10 or the top 100 goals of either socioeconomic system, and that there have been societies whose main goal was not material wealth, and that at least in the top 10, spiritual satisfaction and relationships between individuals and personal growth and so forth were much more important. And that it seems appropriate for the Christian community or the religious community in general in a country to be speaking for those kind of goals. There are plenty of other people speaking for the needs of material welfare, and that work is not that this society really highly values the benefits of work, and so it does. Your own personal feeling about yourself is very closely tied with your performance in the job market, but that it doesn't necessarily, they don't necessarily go together. They just do in this society.
Yeah, I guess there are two points of view to that. One is that we do have a job income link. And if you want to have income, which really relates to existence, you have to have a job. So that's one way of looking at it. And the other one is sort of the psychological, you know, desires, I guess, of work. I did some interesting work last summer for the Ohio Rehabilitation Service, where we did a section on work for them, just tried to define work in our society. And we found out, based on, you know, all the surveys and so on that we could read, that Americans still want to work and they find a lot of satisfaction in work. What they don't like is to be alienated in the sense that they aren't part of what's sort of produced. And that led me to do some more work or some more looking into the Swedish experiment at Volvo, for instance, and Saab, where they sort of took as some people have said, very nice, straight, efficient, highly productive assembly lines and put all kinds of curves and crooks in them and made them very inefficient because they were letting people sort of finish the entire car. Teams of people finished entire cars in order to attempt to remove part of the alienation. They sort of gave up that, by the way, because it became just too inefficient. And the workers didn't really think that that was the answer either. But anyway, there is a lot of satisfaction in work. Somewhere over here there was a comment.
Well, then, I was going to say about the Soviet society that they are so well planned that they have planned to eradicate spiritual growth. And they've done a tremendous job. It's amazing. I was over there just in May, and it was so amazing. Our tour guide was like about 30 years old. And I mean, for her, religion was, well, it was, you know, a part of their past. And I mean, she knew about it historically. But it amazed me that someone of that age was just totally, I mean, God didn't mean a thing.
Yeah. I tend to be be very kind of stoic, you know, as Norwegians are, you know, very unmoved by things. But but I watched the news not too long ago, and I got tears in my eyes, I guess, when I watched the Pope moving through Poland, and so the masses of the people. You know, my wife came up and she said, "Gee, that's the second tear you've had since we've been married. You know, we've been married for 21 years." I tell her, I just kind of pent up my emotions. You know, I really go back and cry a lot when nobody's looking. You know that? No, but is some evidence of that.
We were in Poland also, and we went to Poland before we went to Russia, and we noticed that in Poland, you know, we thought things were kind of bad there as far as religion and stuff, but they really don't have it all that bad compared to the Soviet Union, because they are allowed to, you know, practice, and the churches are all functional and stuff. As far as the Soviet Union, we went into cities where there had been like 30 to 40 churches, and there were only like 4 or 5 that were functional.
Mm-hmm.
The rest were considered museums.
So we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Yeah. That may be a very appropriate closing comment.